Last time we saw that the only thing that matters in life is what? There's only one thing that matters. What he said, do you remember the scene? What was going on? Martha was running around cooking. What was Mary doing? Yeah, just sitting having fellowship with Jesus. And Jesus said, Martha, you're worried about all these different things. There's only one thing that matters, only one thing that's necessary, and it's what Mary chose, not what you chose. It was fellowship with Jesus. That's the only thing. So, what we're doing is we're studying seven different ways that we can get that fellowship. And it's through that fellowship that we get the joy that you were talking about, Josiah. It's through when we have fellowship with Jesus that we get that joy. So, we're trying to find out how to have that fellowship with Jesus. There's seven different ways. We're going to focus on one. Once we learn all seven of them, then we're going to get a life habit of every Monday looking at one, and every Tuesday looking at the next one, and we'll do that for 7 days. But the Monday one is what we've been focusing on. Hungering and thirsting and longing for His presence. Desire. So number one is desire. Hungering and thirsting for God. Remember last time I kept on asking you, how's your appetite? The first indicator of the condition of your heart is your desires. You can tell something's wrong with you when you want the wrong things, when you desire the wrong things. But when you desire the right things, then everything's going to go fine for you because you're going to get those good things. If you're thirsty enough for water, you're going to find a way to get some water. You'll do whatever it takes to get some. But if you don't feel thirsty, you're probably not going to have enough self-discipline to make yourself drink water if you don't feel thirsty. So our goal is to get so that we have so much faith. We have as much faith in the goodness of God for our souls that we have in water for our bodies. You have a lot of faith in water when it comes to thirst, right? As soon as you're thirsty, you don't ever think, oh, I wonder if water will work. You never worry about that. You have total faith that it will. So the thirst itself actually is the exact same thing as wanting water. And you don't have to discipline yourself to drink as long as you're thirsty. Same thing with spending time with God. You don't have to discipline yourself to do it as long as you're thirsting for it and longing for it. And so that's what we're trying to get to, is where we have that longing and thirsting. Just as the pain of thirst in your mind is the exact same thing as the desire for water, we need to get so the pain of life is the exact same thing in your mind as a desire for God. You understand that? So every time you feel any pain, your first thought is going to be, oh, I just felt a longing for God. Anytime you feel any pain, your first thought is, oh, I just experienced a longing for God. So for you, that's what pain is. But if you get your wires crossed in your soul so that your desires crave the wrong thing, then you're in real trouble. Remember we talked about last time, if every time your stomach were hungry, you just wanted, you craved broken glass, you know, to eat, that would kill you. Well, that's how it is with our hunger for God. Our souls are hungry for God, but we crave other things that won't satisfy that hunger. We think, oh, these other things are going to satisfy me, and they won't. They never will. Now, that sheet that I handed out with the five passages of Scripture, those are just five examples of passages that talk about hungering and thirsting after God. And I just wanted to quick talk about each of those five. We only talked about the first one last time, Psalm 42, about the deer. Now let's look at the other four. First, let's look at that Psalm 84:1 real quick. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Yahweh Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of Yahweh. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Now, he says a lot of things in there. And I was just thinking about that verse when I was reading it. It takes a lot of joy to get your soul to yearn for something. It takes even greater joy to get it to faint for something. And then it takes a greater joy still to bring your flesh and soul and your whole being to cry out and shout for joy for that thing. Most of us aren't even at that first stage of just yearning. I mean, I can tell you, I'm finally at the point in my life where I can honestly say, I really enjoy the time I spend alone with God in the morning. Which I haven't really been able to say before in my life, but now I do. I really enjoy that time. But as much as I enjoy it, the honest truth is I don't really mind postponing it a little while. If I got some email or something, I would read it. A package comes to the door, I'll open up the package and see what's in it. I want to get like these psalmists were, where they just couldn't wait. They would not put it off. They wouldn't let anything get in the way. Every day I beg God to give me that kind of gripping, controlling, dominating, passionate, incessant, insistent need to be in His presence and to see His glory. So I just have to do it. I want to get to the point where my heart is and flesh cry out for the living God. Heart and flesh, that means your body. Even your body longs to spend time with God. That's kind of what we're going to talk about today. If you were here, were there last time, and I kept saying, how's your appetite? And I just you read those passages on that passage, the paper, piece of paper, you're probably thinking, man, my appetite is terrible. I don't have anywhere near the longing and desire for God that I should have. And that's why we're going to be studying today about, today and next time, about how to get that longing. I did tell you one thing you can do. There's four things we can do. And I told you the first one last week. Anybody remember what the first one is? Yeah, how do you get so you hunger and thirst? Pray for it. Beg God to give you that hunger and thirst.
Oh, yeah, that's the first thing that you're always going to do.
Yeah, that's always the first thing. Anytime I give you a list, that's always the first thing. Because it's God's doing. You can't just, I mean, you can do the other three things on the list and they won't work unless God just decides to let you have this grace. So you've got to beg God for it. And if you just ask God for it once in a while, He probably won't give it to you. You have to really, really want it. That's the great thing about prayer, is you can show God how bad you want something by how hard you pray for it, how often and how long. So, beg God for it. This is the kind of thing that I was talking about in my prayer when I was saying about inclining my heart. This is what I meant by that. When you look at things, and you make judgments about things, you're not just like a computer where you just gain information and say, oh, that thing is rectangular, and you know that thing's big and that thing's small, and what you don't just get information like that. When you look at things, not only do you get information about what the thing is like, but you also have a sense of either liking it or not liking it. That's what I mean by being inclined. Being inclined means to be tipped. You're either tipped towards it or tipped away from it. So you see a certain thing, you know, like a jalapeno on a pizza, and you're either inclined towards it or you're inclined away from it. I mean, you see it, and you don't just observe, oh, that's a vegetable on a pizza. You look at it, and you either have some sense of liking it or some sense of disliking it. Depending on whether your senses are twisted or normal. So, the same thing with everyone else. You see a person, and you're inclined towards that person, you're inclined away from that person. And you can't really just flip a switch and change it. You can't say, you know, you can't listen to a song on the radio and all of a sudden, you know, you're inclined away from it because you hate it and you hate the way it sounds. And then say, all of a sudden, I'm just going to make myself so I just love that song. It's my favorite song. You can't do that. You can't, right? You can't incline yourself one way or the other. Or if you just really love, you know, ice cream or something, and you can't just say, you know what, from now on, I'm going to just hate ice cream. You can't do that, right? So it's God who inclines your heart. Now, if you're inclined a little bit, then it, you know, one way or the other, then it doesn't have much effect on your life. But if you're inclined really heavily, like you're just madly in love with a person or something, or you just hate the person with all your being or something like that, you're really tipped far one way or the other, that's going to affect your life big time. And what these psalmists, they are just tipped toward God so far that it affects their bodies. It affects their heart, it affects their emotions, it affects the way they feel, it affects everything. And only God can tip the heart that far, one way or the other. And so that's why I say, beg God, beg God, beg Him and beg Him and beg Him, plead with Him to tip your heart towards Him so that when you encounter His Word, you'll love it. And when you hear truth about Him, you'll love it. When you spend time with Him, you'll love it. So that's number one, beg God. All right. Now, that's number one, and we're going to look at three more ways to get this, to get so you hunger and thirst. The first insight comes from Psalm 63:1. Everybody found it? All right. People told me I should give more time for people to look stuff up. All right, somebody read verse 0. Actually, if you don't know on your sheet there, if you got anybody looking at your Bible?
Yes.
Okay, read verse 0.
The Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness.
Okay. The Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness or the desert of Judah. That's that little thing that becomes before verse 1. It's still part of the Bible. It's part of Scripture. But it's verse 0. That's the key to understanding this second way of getting thirst for God. He wrote this psalm about being so thirsty. He goes on to say, "Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water." David got thirsty for God when he was in the desert, where his body was tired and thirsty for water. When he was in that miserable, hot, painful circumstance, and his body was hungry and thirsty, that suffering helped him learn how to become hungry and thirsty for God. Suffering can do that. Suffering can create a thirst in your soul for God. But suffering doesn't automatically make you hunger and thirst after God. It's possible to be out in the desert or in some other horrible circumstance, to be suffering in some horrible way, and not have any appetite for God. So, how do you make it so that your suffering causes you to hunger and thirst after God? And it's not wasted. Here's how. When David realized that he was in the desert, longing for water and refreshment, what he realized was this. He realized that what he wanted most really wasn't water and refreshment. What he wanted most was really fellowship with God, because he knew that the experience of God's love is better than the best things of life. Remember that? We talked about that last week. Your love is better than life, Psalm 33. The experience of God's love is actually better than the best things in life. That means if David got food and water, but he didn't enjoy the experience of God's love, he wouldn't be happy. He wouldn't be satisfied. But if he did enjoy the experience of love from God, even if he didn't get any more food or water, he'd still be satisfied and happy. And so he realized that what he was really longing for and wanting was the experience of fellowship with God. And the more intense the suffering, the more it helped him realize how much his soul needed God. Because the more pain he felt in his body, the more he said, "Wow, this is what my soul really wants from God. This is how bad my soul really needs God." It's hard to understand how bad your soul needs God until your body really needs something. Does that make sense? So whenever you suffer, however much you want relief, you can tell yourself, "That's how much my soul wants fellowship with God." If you're super thirsty, you can say, "That's how much my soul really needs God." So, let me give you an example of some suffering. Imagine you write a paper for school, and you do it all by yourself, you do all the work yourself, you really work hard on it, and you turn it in, you think you're going to get an A, you're so excited, teacher gives it back and says, "This writing is so good, there's no way you could have done it. You must have copied it," and so you get an F. And you end up failing a class, and you have to go to summer school. All because... So you end up failing the class, you have to go to summer school, all because you did a good job writing a paper. Now that would be pretty unfair, right? If that happened to you. Would that get you upset? Okay. If you would get upset about that, the reason you're getting upset is because you desire something that you're not getting. What is it that you're desiring and not getting? Fairness. You desire fairness. You're not getting it. Now, if you just stop right there, then it's not going to help you long for God more. It's not going to help you. That suffering isn't going to help you thirst for God anymore, and all your suffering is going to be wasted. But if you take the next step and think like David thought, then here's what you're going to think. You're going to think, "I want fairness so bad, because fairness and justice is one of the good things in life, but experiencing God's love is better than the best things in life, which means as much as I want fairness right now, fellowship with God would even be better than getting fairness. And so even the more I want fairness, even though I want fairness so much, the more I want fairness, I want fellowship with God even more than that. When I have close fellowship with God, and He smiles on my life, and I enjoy that, not only will I get fairness then, but I'll get something a million times better than fairness, and that is fellowship with Him. So that's the way he thought. And if you think that way, every time you suffer, it'll cause a hunger and thirst for fellowship with God, because you'll realize it's better than the thing that you're longing for. All right, if your hand hurts from hitting something hard, you got a sore hand or you get some pain in your body, what do you long for? What do you want? Relief from the suffering, right? You want to feel better. And then, how do you think like David? Yeah, fellowship with God would be better than my hand being fixed. Or if you're really, really hot and miserable, you think, man, I'd love to be cooled off. You think fellowship with God would feel even better than being cooled off. That's the way you do it. I have a problem with my blood sugar levels. And so once in a while I have a blood sugar crash. I just totally run out of energy. And I get really weak and dizzy and I have to lay down for like 15 minutes. And it's a terrible feeling. I hate it when it happens. I feel just horribly weak when that happens. Which is perfect for this. Because whenever that happens now, I get that feeling. I think, oh, this is how my soul feels when I've gone without fellowship with God. This is the way my soul is this weak, this shaky. And so now each time I have that kind of a crash or I feel weak or I feel tired, it reminds me of the emptiness of my soul when I haven't had communion with God. And the more I think about that, the more it'll cause me to have desire for God. So let's try it. Let's try to practice this. Somebody tell me about what some kind of suffering in your life, either a big thing or a little thing. Biology?
Yeah.
That's your big trial, biology?
Chemistry.
What's hard about it? I mean, what's bad about it? Okay. So let's follow this David's reasoning. What would David think? If he were in that class.
Biology. Biology.
Biology. Yeah, the thing that he desires is to be able to understand it and for it to be able to do it. And fellowship with God, if you had it, would be even better than this thing that you're desiring. So you can think of it, you can apply it to anything. All right. All right, what's yours?
Well, I was reading that a lot of people were cheating, so I quit, but they just want to prove that they're better than me. They just go everywhere and they follow me.
So what is it that you desire that you're not getting?
One time with myself.
Yeah, or for those guys to treat you better, right? And then, so how would David think about that? No, that's not it. What he would think is fellowship with God. If you had fellowship with God, you would like that even more than you would like it if those people treated you the right way. You understand that? So you can always think, fellowship with God is even better than this thing I want. That's how suffering helps. Now,
and share more about that. Then.
Yeah. The people who wrote these psalms thought that way so much that they could actually write these verses that are on these pieces of paper that I handed out, and they really meant them. I mean, they were really telling the truth when they said those things. It's actually true that they enjoyed their devotion time more than enjoyed anything else in life. Can you imagine that? For you to enjoy your prayer time, your devotion time, more than you enjoy anything else in life. Now, one of the ways that the Bible writers describe this longing for God is with the term wait. W-A-I-T, wait. Look at Isaiah 26, 8 and 9 on your sheet there. It says, yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desire of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night, in the morning my spirit longs for you. Okay, he's talking about that yearning, that longing, that hunger, and that thirst, and it's connected with waiting for God. Same thing with Psalm 130. Is that one on your sheet, Psalm 135 and 6?
No.
Okay, I'll read it to you. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman for the morning, more than the watchman waits for the morning. That's 130, verses 5 and 6. That's an important one. I should have put that on there. My soul waits for God more than the watchman waits for morning. Now, here's what I want you to think about for a minute. What does it mean to wait? Okay.
Be patient and not get frustrated.
That's what most people think. When they think that's what waiting means, is wait without getting agitated and antsy. And the younger you are, the more you think that, because the more your mom told you that. Be patient. And that just means stop bugging me. But that's not really what waiting means. So let's think if we can sort out this word wait. What does the word wait actually mean? Here's what I was thinking when I was thinking about what the word waiting means. First I thought, well, waiting is just like existing until something happens. It's just sort of standing around. Like if you're waiting to be picked up from school, you're standing on the curb waiting. What are you doing? Well, you're just standing there. But is waiting just standing around doing nothing? And the answer, I think, is no. There's more to waiting than that. Because suppose you're waiting to be picked up from school, and your ride is supposed to arrive. Your mom's supposed to pick you up at 2:45, okay?
Or your dad.
Now, Now, suppose there's another bus or another car that's coming to pick someone else up that's also going to get there at 2:45. Are you waiting for that second car? No. You're waiting for your car, but not the other car. So you're standing there the whole time until that second car gets there, but that's not waiting, right? You're only waiting for the one that's coming for you. So waiting doesn't just mean standing around until something happens. Because if that were the definition, then you'd be waiting for both cars the same way. It's the same way with waiting for a person. Suppose your best friend is going to come over tonight at 6 o'clock. And you haven't seen this friend for years, and you're super excited to see this friend showing up at 6 o'clock. And so you're waiting. And say now it's 5 o'clock, so you have an hour to wait. So you're waiting for an hour. Well, suppose your dad's friend is also coming over at 6 o'clock. Are you waiting for that guy?
No.
No. So what does it mean to wait? Yeah, you're looking forward. When you're waiting for something, you're looking forward to that thing.
Just like the race, I was looking forward to the end of the race
right, to
see if I won.
Yeah, you weren't waiting to find out, you know, what time someone else got. You were waiting to find out how you did. You weren't waiting to find out how some other person, some other race, you know, did. So it means looking forward to the thing you're waiting for. The psalmist says, "My soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman wait for the morning." Now, a watchman was a guy who had to stay up. Imagine having this job. He has to stay up all night and just watch and keep guard over the camp or the city and just watch all night. And most nights, nothing happened, which is what they hoped for. Nobody came and attacked or anything. So for hour after hour after hour, just watch nothing.
Just watch the sunrise.
Well, it was before the sunrise. Sunrise, sun came up and his shift was over. Now, he doesn't have a Game Boy, he doesn't have a magazine, he doesn't have an iPod, he doesn't have any music. He just sat there in dead silence, stared out into the dark, and watched for intruders that never came. He did that hour after hour after hour after hour. Now, can you imagine what that would be like to have that job? I mean, how incredibly boring it would be to just sit there and look at another thing for hours. And imagine how tired you'd be. You're up all night. You're dead tired. All you want to do is just lay down. You just want to close your eyes so bad. You start thinking about your bed at home, and you just think, oh, if I could just lay down and get some rest. And you get so you just can't wait for the morning to come. Did that ever happen to someone where you've just couldn't wait for morning? Yeah, last night. I remember one time I was with a friend, visiting a friend up in some cabin or something, and we slept outside, and it rained.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I had this cheesy little sleeping bag, and I just got completely soaked. And I was freezing, I was shivering, I was soaked, my sleeping bag was soaked. And I just couldn't wait for the morning. I'd look at my watch, and, you know, it was like 10 o'clock. I thought it was almost morning, it was like 10 o'clock. And then I'd lay there for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And then I'd look at my watch again, it's like 10:15. It's the longest night of my life.
That's what wasn't really camping that one time at the Easter. Oh my goodness.
So that's what That's what waiting is like. That's what he said waiting is like. You're looking forward to the morning. Now, the morning was still future for the watchman, right? The next night when he started his shift again, that's also in the future. Is he waiting for that? No. See, both things are in the future, but he's only waiting for the thing that he's looking forward to. So you starting to understand what waiting is? And Jay hit it when he said kind of a funny thing. He said, I can't wait to the end of the race. When you use that phrase, I can't wait, that's what the Bible means when it says wait. It's the feeling of, I can't wait. It's that anticipation, longing. When Christmas is coming up and you feel like you can't wait to open those presents, a few days before you look at the presents, you just can't wait for it to come. When you're a little kid, that's what that feeling is, what the Bible talks about when it talks about waiting. Or you have a week left of school, summer break is about to start, you can't wait for summer break, that's waiting. No. When you have some terrible test coming up and next week and you dread that, that's not waiting. Okay? That's not what this is talking about. Or if someone's coming to your house but you don't care about his arrival, that's not waiting. Or even if you have some good thing coming in the future, but you're not really thinking about it, like suppose, you know, big summer break is coming up and you're really looking forward to that, but right now you're so engrossed in the present that you're not really thinking about next week, and so you've kind of forgotten about that. That's not waiting. Waiting is when you're focused on that thing, you're thinking about it, and you can't wait for it to come. That's what waiting is. Now that you know what waiting is, think about what the psalmist says when he says he waits for the Lord. All those times in your life when you have those little moments of emptiness, when tiny little things irritate you, you know, and tiny little things depress you, you feel down for no reason, you feel depressed for no reason, you don't even know why you're down, those are indications of the longing of the soul for satisfaction that can't be found in anything in this world. And the more petty the thing that bothers you, the less petty the longing is. You understand that? When some tiny, tiny, tiny little thing really bugs you, that means the longing in your soul is really, really big. So the goal is to let those moments of longing be turned into and be translated into intense longing for the next time that you get to have close fellowship with God. So your mom says something in some tone of voice that just bugs you, you know, or something irritates you, and it's really not any big deal, but for some reason it just really bugs you at this moment. Or you lose something, and you're just so frustrated you can hardly stand it, you know. Or sometimes all you do is drop something, and you just, man, you just want to scream, you know. Right? When those little things bother you, when those little tiny things bother you, here's what you need to think in your mind. You need to think, my soul must be starving for fellowship with God. This pain and frustration that I feel, it won't ever go away until my soul has been touched by the presence of God. I can't wait until that happens. This longing in my soul will never go away. I'll never feel better until my soul has been touched by the presence of God. I can't wait until that happens. That's what it means to wait on God. When you just can't wait for something, like Christmas morning or your best friend to arrive, the reason you say, I can't wait, why do we say, I can't wait? Why do we say that? I mean, of course you can wait. Why do you say you can't wait? The reason you say you can't wait is because it's almost, you're so eager for it to happen, it's almost like there's a kind of pain in waiting. Do you remember that when you were a little kid? You're looking at those presents a couple days before Christmas and you're just going crazy. It's like you got pain inside your soul. Wanting to... That's a funny kind of pain, isn't it? I mean, you think about it. If there were no gifts under the tree, the pain would be gone. Right? If there were nothing good, then you wouldn't have that pain of waiting. If this friend that you just can't wait till he gets here, if you didn't really like him, then there would be no pain in waiting. The pain is caused by how wonderful the thing is that you're waiting for. Waiting on God means to be so eager to have fellowship with Him that it's almost painful to wait until the next time you can spend time in prayer with Him. So pray to God, and that's why I said beg Him over and over and over, beg God. God, please let me know the pain of wanting you so bad that I can't wait until my next prayer time. Let it be the pain of anticipating something so wonderful that I feel like I have to have it now. Let me experience that. So that's one part of waiting. Eagerly looking forward to something that you want so bad that you feel like you can't wait. That's one part of waiting. Now let me tell you about one other part of waiting. That's still not all there is to waiting. There's another important part. The other important part of waiting is deciding not to do something else. Okay? If you're waiting for your mom to pick you up from school, and you stand there for 10 seconds, and after 10 seconds say, you know what, I think I'll just ride home with my friend. So you jump in your friend's car, and you ride home, with your, you get a ride home from your friend. Then you're at home. 45 minutes later, your mom finally comes back. And she sees you, and she says, why didn't you...
Wait.
Yeah, wait. Well, what does she mean by that?
Why didn't you stay there?
Yeah, why didn't you decide not to take another way home? So part of waiting is not doing something else. Not getting some other option. If a man and a woman are in love, and the man is still in college, so he can't really get married, and so he says to the woman, just wait for me to finish college. What is he asking her to do? He's asking her, how does she wait for him? She waits for him by not marrying anybody else. Right? So waiting means not going after something else to fulfill what your longing is. Now, back to those crummy moments in life when you're irritated, you're frustrated, you're depressed, you feel empty inside, whatever. When you have those kinds of moments and you just feel like life just isn't what it should be, it's not quite right, when that happens, you need to say to yourself, I'll wait. I'll wait. God, I will wait the next time that you let me feel your presence, and then I'll be satisfied. I'll let you satisfy the thirst of my soul. And what does that kind of waiting mean? It means you're not going to do what? You're not going to look for anything else to satisfy that thirst. You're not going to look for any other method of making yourself feel better. So, if those times come into your life, when you're dissatisfied and you try to make yourself feel better by eating something, or by watching a movie, or by doing something fun, or by doing some sin, that's like taking another ride home instead of waiting for your mom to pick you up. God wants us to wait for Him, and that means deciding not to find some other satisfaction for our souls. He wants us to wait because He knows that nothing else will satisfy the soul. See, that's the thing where the illustration breaks down. Because if you take another ride home from school, you still get home, right? But that's not how it is when we fail to wait for God. Failing to wait for God and finding some substitute is like getting in a car at school that doesn't take you home. They just take you out into the middle of the desert and then dump you off and leave you there. That's what it's like when we find some other substitute besides God to make ourselves feel better. When you feel bad and you turn to something besides God to make you to satisfy that emptiness in your soul, something like exercise or friendship or talking on the phone or sports or video games or I am or shopping or whatever. Jeremiah 2:13 calls those things broken water tanks that cannot hold water. They'll never really satisfy, but God is like a spring of water that will satisfy. So waiting for God means eagerly and joyfully looking forward to and longing for fellowship with Him like you can't wait for it. And in the meantime, until that happens, it means refusing to satisfy the longings with a substitute. You got those two parts? What are the two parts to waiting on God? That's right. Not going to any substitute. That's good. And then what's the first one?
Desiring for the future.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. That's what it means to wait. All right. So far we've learned two ways to get the thirst for God. Your first way to get thirst for God is to beg God for it, pray. The second way to get thirst for God is to turn all of the pain in life into waiting for God and thirsting and hungering for God. Use all your discomfort and all of your depression and all of your suffering in your life to remind yourself of how much your soul longs for God. To remind yourself that, oh, fellowship with God would be better than this thing I'm longing for. So suffering really helps. So those are the first two ways. All right, we'll do one more. Number three way to get your soul to thirst for God. Remember. Remember God's works in the past. Do I have Psalm 143, 4 to 6 on that sheet?
Yeah.
All right, let's look at Psalm 143, 4 to 6. So my spirit grows faint within me. My heart within me is dismayed. I remember the days of long ago. I meditate on all your works and consider what your hands have done. I spread out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land. How does he get to his soul thirsts for God? He remembers. Okay? So this is the third way to get your soul to thirst for God, to remember. See, suffering is a good way. But you're not always suffering, right? Sometimes, you haven't always felt bad. There's been sometimes in your life when you felt great. And you've been full of energy, you've been full of hope, you've been full of joy, you've been happy. Those are times when God was smiling on you and showing you His kindness. And when you feel bad, God wants you to remember those good times so that you'll long for those to return. Remembering past experiences of God's love will make you hunger and thirst for God's love now. And the reason God let you feel good like that in the past was so that you would turn and pay attention to His love and respond to Him in love. The psalmist here is remembering the wonderful times in the past that created hunger and thirst and longing. He's saying, oh, I wish it could be like it used to be. And that creates hunger and thirst. But now this is the important part. Make sure you get this. He's not longing for those good times. He's not just longing for those good times. He's longing for the favor of God and the fellowship of God that was connected with those good times. The good times alone, without fellowship with God, would be worthless to him. What he's longing for is the favor from God and the fellowship with God. See, but one thing that David and these guys understood is that the funnest, most wonderful time you've ever had in your life is just like a sample of what fellowship with God is like. It's a sample. All the times that you've ever felt good and that you've been happy in your life, those are all samples of what fellowship with God is like. You've never really had the full thing. All you've ever had is like a sample. You ever go to the grocery store and they have samples? You know, you go to Sam's or you go to some grocery store on a Saturday and they get free samples. You take a little bite of something. You guys know about that? Okay.
Yeah,
that's it. See, that's the thing. That's what I do, too. They give you one little bite of something. And why are they giving that stuff away for free? What are they hoping?
They want a taste.
Yeah, they want you to get a taste so that you'll want to buy a whole package. Right? That's what God was doing every time He let you feel some pleasure or some happiness in your life. He was giving you a sample so that you'd want to buy the whole package. What's the package? Fellowship with Christ. Fellowship with Him. Every little pleasure, every little fun thing you've ever done, a ski trip, a vacation, a game, or, you know, time with a friend, every fun thing you've ever done is a sample of what fellowship with God is like. But so often, we do with God the same thing that me and Jay do with the samples at the store. And what is that? That's right. We just go and we just eat the sample with absolutely no intention whatsoever of buying what's in the package. We just go from sample to sample to sample. And all we care about is the sample. That's right. I've had a lot of samples. I don't think I've ever bought anything that I had sampled. And that's the way we, too often we are with happiness that comes from God. We just take the sample, but we're not interested in the package. We'll take the ski trip, but we don't really care about the fellowship with God, which is so much more of that little bit of joy that came in the ski trip. We're just satisfied with this tiny little bit of joy, not the whole package. That's why C.S. Lewis said we're too easily satisfied. But the psalmist wasn't like that. He remembered what those samples tasted like, and that made him crave what? fellowship with God. So I've been trying to do this the last couple of weeks. I've been trying to remember past things that God has done that will make me crave fellowship with God. And I have found it to be very, very hard. It's not easy. It's a lot of work trying to remember God works in such a way that it makes you long for Him. It's kind of like a muscle, and if you don't use it, it just atrophies and becomes so weak until you can hardly move it. It's something that most Christians never do, remembering God's works in the past. In fact, most Christians spend more time thinking about their past sins and failures than they spend thinking about what God has done in the past that's good. Why is that? Why do we want to do that? It's amazing. You think about your past sin, it makes you miserable, and yet we'd rather do that than wallow in the pain of regret instead of rejoicing in the hope of remembering God's goodness. If it's so painful to focus on our past sins, why not remember God's works instead of your works? When your own works condemn you, let the memory of God's works refresh you. When the works of your own hands grieve you, let the works of God's hands give you hope and joy. Let the memory of that cause a deep longing in your soul. We saw this in Psalm 63 when David was out there in the desert. That's where we started with Psalm 63. Remember, he was in the desert. In verses 6 and 7 of that psalm, he says, "Whenever I remember you on my bed, I think of you through the watches of the night. Because you are my help, I sing in the shadow of your wings." He says, "Whenever I remember you on my bed, I think of you through the watches of the night." Remember, David's on the run. He's running for his life. He's in the desert. He's laying on whatever hard, uncomfortable bed he had out there in the desert. And he's laying there, and he can't sleep, and all of a sudden he remembers God. He remembers the things that God did in the past. And whenever he did that, he would start meditating about God. Whenever I do that, whenever I remember God, I think about it for like 5 seconds, and then I'm off to the next thing. Not David. Whenever he remembered what God did, it would get him to meditating, and it would start up his mind. And nighttime is the perfect time for this, because in the daytime, you're busy, you're doing stuff, and there's a lot of distractions. You don't have time to think deeply about God most of the time. But at night, the darkness and the quiet allow for long periods of deep contemplation. And this is always what you should do on those nights when you can't sleep. If God isn't granting you sleep, it's probably because He wants you to spend some time with Him. And if you just put forth the effort of remembering the things that He's done and thinking hard about the truths of God that you've learned recently, and then when you think about those memories of God's works and how those memories fit in with this new truth about God that you've been learning, this attribute of God that you're thinking about, you would experience the presence of God and joy and satisfaction would flood your soul. So, and then if that happened, whether you got any sleep or not, the experience would leave you satisfied and full of hope and energized and cleansed and empowered when you got up the next day, even if you're physically tired. I think the reason most of our memories about God don't launch us into deep meditation is because our first thoughts of God are so shallow that we never really get a taste of His presence and His glory. It's like putting a nut in your mouth and tasting the shell and then saying, "This isn't satisfying me," and spitting it out. You think about God for 10 seconds and then you move on to something else, you spit it out because you do that a whole bunch of times until you train your spirit to think, you know, God isn't all that satisfying. Thinking about God isn't all that satisfying. It doesn't taste good. It doesn't taste good because you've never really tasted it. You've just tasted the shell of the nut. You've never gotten into that nut on the inside. Almost every day, you remember something from the past that was good. We all do that. This is the way God made us. Sometime during the day, you have some memory that you go back to say, "Oh, that was fun. I liked that. I felt good there. That was a good thing. I told a joke and everybody laughed," and you kind of replay it in your mind, or I did this thing and it worked out great, or I got this great good grade, or something, you know, whatever. You think through some good thing, some good memory. We all like to remember good things. But there's two different ways to enjoy that memory. You can just think about the thing that happened and how good it felt, and that's it. And if that's all you do, that's like worshiping that thing as if it were an idol. Or another way you can enjoy it is you can think about that event as an expression of God's love, and you can enjoy God while remembering the event. And if you do that, that's fellowship with God. Whenever you find yourself remembering something good, anything good from your past, let that memory be a memory of something God did, not just a memory of an event. And picture God doing it. Imagine God doing it, showing you love. And then you'll have fellowship with Him. And then you enjoy that memory, and you savor that memory in your mind, and you roll it over in your mind and think about it and enjoy it. Make sure that what you're enjoying is the thought of God showing you love, not just the event. Now, this is going to be a lot... I'm almost done here. This is going to be a lot easier if we realize that those things are expressions of God's love right when they happen. That'll make it just a lot easier. What if you try this week? Just like you did the thing I said last week. What if you try this week?
Pen and paper should be out.
or if you remember to have to hand these out, then you'll have it here.
Okay.
What if every night, as you're going to sleep, for the next 7 nights, or the next 100 nights, or if you do this the rest of your life, what if you're laying there on your pillow and you just replay all of the gestures of love that God showed you that previous day? So you just go from the morning when you woke up until right now when you're laying in your bed, and you just think all the things God did for you. Every good thing that happened and every bad thing that He protected you from that didn't happen.
Like the flat tire I got. Going down the road. Yeah. I had a window like that. And I pulled over to fix it. But I didn't fly off the road into the ditch.
Yes. Yeah. Protected you from dying. That's good.
I had it there.
Yep. And your other three stayed pumped up.
Yep. Yep.
I think about this, you know, every time I have a close call and I think something could have, you know, happened a different, or I see somebody who's going in a wheelchair or something, and all the things that He protects me from. Or I just think of the fact that, man, right now, Satan and demons are 1 foot away from me with their swords flailing. And if God just let down the shield for 1 second, I would be blasted. I would be smashed to pieces by them. I mean, they could destroy me and pull me into sin and ruin my life so fast if God didn't protect me. So He's protected me from temptations. I walk around a corner and God, there might be a temptation in there, and God removes me because He knows I can't handle it. And He's doing that every minute of the day, protecting me from all kinds of temptations. So all the stuff God protected you from and all the stuff that God did for you, good things, kindnesses that He just showed you all through the day, you just think about that as you lay in bed. And think about each one of those things being a love letter from God, an expression of love from God. And then remember and think about at least one thing from the Bible that God did. So you're thinking about stuff in your own life, and you're thinking about stuff in the Bible. So you think about, you remember like the time when God had mercy on Mary in her humility, or when He drew Joseph out of prison and elevated him to glory, or when He granted forgiveness to Peter after Peter denied Him publicly, or when He met Elijah in the wilderness when he was in desperate straits and he was about to die, and He refreshed him and strengthened him all by himself out there, or when He sent angels to minister to Jesus after the 40 days of testing in the desert, or when He stood by Paul when everyone else deserted him, or when He made the sun stand still for Joshua, or when He provided a husband and a redeemer for the widow Ruth, or when He moved heaven and earth to rescue hundreds of thousands of Israelites from Egypt, or when He fed and cared for a single sparrow who can't even hop on the ground without God taking notice and providing daily food and shelter, or when He clothed the lily of the field with some flower that nobody ever even saw, and God clothed that flower with more glorious beauty than even the most beautiful garments King Solomon ever wore. Any of those kinds of things. You just think about something that God did in Scripture that showed His love, and all the things He did during that day, and things earlier in your life. Every time you have a pleasant memory, you think of God as doing those things. Every night, as you're going to sleep, you remember the things God has done, both in your life from a long time ago, and the things in that day, and the things in Scripture. And let your memory of those things cause longing and hungering and thirsting after Him for fellowship with Him. Saying that's what fellowship with God is like. All right. So what are the three things that we learn on how to create this hunger and thirst for God?
Well,
what we're supposed to do?
Yeah, things that you do. What?
When we go to bed, we think about, like, that day from morning to...
Okay, remember. That's one. Remember. That's right. Pray. Beg God. And I use the word beg instead of pray because I'm talking about really begging God. Beg, wait, turn all your suffering, translate all your suffering into a thirst for Him, and remember. And there's one more, and we'll do that next week.